If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Janine, host of the Olive Magazine podcast, and this is part one of a special four-part series where we'll be taking a deep dive into the subject of baking with some brilliant expert guests. This episode sees Olive columnist and podcast regular Ed Kimber giving his top tips and tricks to help raise your baking game, including next-level buttercream, secret ingredients that can boost the flavour of chocolate, and some new baking trends to look out for. Welcome to the podcast, Ed Kimber.
Thank you for having me again. Not bored of me yet?
No. The reason I asked you to come on is we're doing a special series of four podcasts about baking. And obviously you are Olive's baking expert. So I wanted to dive into your expertise to talk about really how we can, as reasonably confident bakers, you know, people who can turn out a lovely cake or a plate of biscuits, how we can kind of turn up the volume on that mm-hmm. and take our bakes to the next level. Because I know from reading your columns in Olive Magazine that you have tons of tips and tricks designed, you know, to give your bakes that extra pizzazz. So I've got a few different mm-hmm. little subjects I want to touch on. But let's start first with chocolate,
because
everybody loves a rich chocolate cake. Yeah. You've got an amazing devil's food cake in our latest issue on the cover, or a chocolate biscuit. How can we turn up the volume on that? How can we make that into a better bake?
So in that recipe, for example, the actual recipe itself isn't super different from a kind of classic devil's food. There's a few things that I do to enhance flavor with chocolate. So in a cake itself, when you add chocolate, this one has chocolate and cocoa, which gives a nice balance of flavor, because sometimes when you add cocoa powder, that's going to give you the intensity of flavor.
Yeah.
But adding the chocolate adds cocoa butter, which can give a really nice texture and round out the flavor in the cake as well. But because you're adding flour, you're adding sugar, you're adding eggs, all those things will help to dull the flavor of chocolate because it's helping to cover it up. So adding things like, there's a liquid in the recipe, and using coffee in that can help give more of that roasty flavor that won't taste of coffee, but it will help to bring out the chocolate that's already there. And it's interesting because when you put coffee in a chocolate cake, you will inevitably get questions from people saying, will it taste of coffee? And you can put really strong coffee in it, and you might get these. I've put espresso in coffee cakes, in chocolate cakes before, and you can taste something, but most people wouldn't go, oh, this is a coffee cake. But because you know, coffee beans and cocoa beans are not, you know, crazily dissimilar products. Mm. And they're often, they're processed in a similar way in the way that they're roasted and dried and whatever. And it can just help give more of that base note to the recipe. So yeah. It's kind of adding another level to it. But then in that recipe, I also added a small portion of rye flour. And rye flour is just, I call it like a magical pairing with chocolate because it's a fairly acidic flour. And it can add this brightness, and it does a similar thing to salt almost. It can help bring out flavors. It can help pair really nicely. And I think chocolate and rye are just made for each other. I think they both help to bring out each other's flavors and increase the depth of flavor in the cake. Because that's kind of what you're doing. It's not adding more chocolate to make it more chocolatey. It's trying to help bring out the flavors that are already there and add other levels of depth to it. But I think one of the most important things that a lot of people won't think about with chocolate recipes is salt, is adding enough salt to chocolate, because baking is still, you know, it's still food and still needs seasoning. Yeah, but it also plays a really important role in flavor because salt helps to reduce the sweetness, obviously, but it also helps to bring out flavors, and it works so well with chocolate. If you have, say, a chocolate chip cookie that has a little bit of salt on the top versus one that doesn't, even if you couldn't taste the salt, you would taste something stronger. And so adding enough salt to a recipe can really, really help. I was randomly in a friend's kitchen the other weekend. There was a whole bunch of us together, a whole bunch of different pastry chefs, and we wanted to test out what makes the best chocolate cake. So we literally tested a whole bunch over over a day.
Wow.
And one of the ones that came out as noticeably different had, but it had too much salt, let's say that. But it had a presence of salt that really just made everything really bright. And we could tell when things just didn't have enough salt because it really was, it was flat. Like with cooking, you know, it can really help make it more dynamic. And you're not talking a lot of salt, you're just talking the right amount,
like a pinch.
Yeah.
How many cakes did you go through before you got to the?
I think we made, so there was five of us. Did we make six or seven? But guess which one came out really highly, which we were all quite shocked about. So we made a very famous person's cake.
Oh, you were using recipes that were out there in the in the wild.
For one of them we did, but the other ones was kind of a higgled mess of a recipe. We jumbled together on the day.
Together based on what you thought would work.
Yeah, and that was one recipe that we all tested. But then we threw in one extra one because it was vegan and we wanted to try a vegan recipe. Cool. But it was Nigella's vegan chocolate cake. And it's delicious on its own. It's great on its own. But we wanted to add chocolate to it because it's only cocoa powder based. And adding chocolate to it made it was already ridiculously good. But adding chocolate to it made this incredible vegan chocolate cake. So I need to play around with that one more because it was very good.
And did you tag her in once you made that discovery?
I think we did, but I don't think she noticed.
Hi, Nigella.
Yeah, I don't think she noticed.
Just
that
ignored
day.
You. It's weird though, isn't it? Because you mentioned cocoa powder, but you know, people would think, oh well, to make the ultimate chocolate cake, you just use chocolate, but you can't.
No.
You always need cocoa powder because you can't get the intensity from just using melted chocolate, and also you wouldn't be able to. There'd be too much of it and it would kind of damage the sponge, I guess, in the end.
Yeah, well, when you're talking about cocoa powder, so really good, what is known as Dutch cocoa powder, which is mainly what you can get in Europe anyway. Mm. The good stuff is around 20 to 24% fat content. And obviously, chocolate has a different fat percentage and the sugar percentage and all those sorts of extra added things. Where when you're adding cocoa powder, you're adding cocoa solids and cocoa butter, effectively.
Right.
And so that's pure chocolate flavor. There's nothing else getting in the way. The fat level is lower, so you're not changing the textures of the recipe too much. But cocoa powder is also quite drying because it can absorb moisture quite a lot. So using chocolate is a nice balance because it can help kind of measure each other out and give you the right texture versus flavor. But to me, cocoa-based cakes, if they're made really well, can have a really light, moist texture. But adding chocolate just gives them a teensy bit more sturdiness, so they make better layer cakes, and has a nicer, to me, it has a better texture when you use both. Although both are great.
Yeah. Let's talk about a little bit about decoration now. Mm-hmm. So we all know how to make buttercream. It's, you know, it's just mixing ice and sugar, some nice salted butter, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know what ratios you use. I think it's kind of, it's usually equal, isn't it? Or you maybe use a little bit more. Yeah.
So one part butter, two part sugar. But it's very sweet.
Yeah. But then I noticed that in your column you've done fancy buttercreams. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Swiss meringue buttercream.
So I don't do a lot of the kind of classic buttercream. It's known as American buttercream because I'm not a huge fan of its texture. It can be very sweet and a little bit grainy unless properly made.
Yeah.
And it's just not my favorite. So I like playing with lots of different variations of buttercream. And they're all classics. It's just they're less well known at home.
Yeah.
So Swiss meringue buttercream is probably one of my go-tos. It's very easy to make. It's actually not complicated at all. It's just, it sounds...
You say that, Edge,
but... It's not, I promise. It just sounds daunting because you've got to make a meringue to make buttercream, but it's really not that difficult. So it's actually easier to make a Swiss meringue than it is to make normal French-style meringue. All you're going to do is put your egg whites and your sugar into a bowl together straight away, and you put the bowl over a pan of simmering water, and you just get it moving. Just gently whisk it. You're not trying to add air. You're just kind of moving it around so it doesn't catch. And as soon as it becomes fairly hot and you can tell it's ready, when you dip your fingers in, rub your fingers together and it'll feel smooth. There'll be no grains of sugar.
Oh, so the sugar's dissolved.
Exactly, yeah. So the sugar's dissolved and it's hot enough that it's pasteurized the egg whites. So the egg whites are safe. You then take it off the heat and then you whisk it for about 7 to 10 minutes. You can do that with an electric hand whisk or a stand mixer. You can't do it with a normal balloon whisk because you just... It won't work. It'll take far too long.
Your arm will drop off.
Exactly. Yeah. Both arms will drop off by the time it's done.
Yeah.
And you end up with this incredibly glossy meringue. It's almost like making marshmallow. And then once that's cool enough, once it's room temperature, you just then add butter to it, piece by piece, softened butter. And by the time you've added all that remaining butter in, it becomes this incredibly smooth, silky buttercream.
Silky,
and it's so smooth, and you can flavor it just how you would any normal buttercream, but its textures are just delicious and so good. Someone once said to me, oh, it tastes very much like butter, and I said, oh, the clue is in the name. It is a buttercream. But that's also because it has less sweetness than a normal buttercream, because you're cooking the sugar. It reduces the sensation of sweetness when you eat it. So it's less sweet than traditional buttercream, and it has a much, much better texture. It takes a little bit more time to make, but I don't think it's complicated. I would put money on people can make this at home with, you know, what you have at home. It's fine.
I think you added a couple of little tips, didn't you, about if you add, there's a couple of things that could possibly go awry.
Basically, only two things that can go wrong with Swiss buttercream, or two common things that go wrong. One is you add the butter to when the meringue is too warm. And it will melt, and instead of forming a nice buttercream texture, it forms this almost mousse-like texture. It's very wet and soupy. Right. That's incredibly easy to rescue. You stop adding any more butter. You throw the bowl in the fridge for 10, 15 minutes, and that will should cool everything down enough that when you whip it again, it then starts to come back together.
Come back,
and then you continue adding your butter, and it should be fine. The other thing that can happen is if the butter you're adding is too cold and you're adding it to the meringue, it can sometimes split. It can kind of break. Mm. And if that happens, you just keep whisking. You just keep it going, and eventually that butter will warm up and it will
warm
form
up with
the buttercream texture. But they're really the only things that can go wrong. And they're very easy to rescue, thankfully. It's one of the easiest, more complex buttercreams.
That to me sounds like a good one. If you're looking for the next level buttercream, that's one that anyone could sort of attempt.
Yeah, I mean, there's another one that I really love, but I think maybe it's more daunting because it's a more confusing process. Because there's one called German buttercream. It's also similar to a few other names, but basically it's custard, and then you beat butter into the custard. So you basically make a very thick pastry cream, and then once that's chilled down, you beat your butter until it's really nice and creamy, light, pale, and then you add the custard to that spoon by spoon, and eventually it whips up into this delicious, delicious buttercream. I really like that one because it's the least sweet, and you can really control the sweetness of that one a lot. And it has a very similar texture, kind of, it's maybe a little bit more moussey, a bit more soft maybe, but it is a delicious buttercream. I like that one a lot at the moment.
Mm. I like the sound of them. They sound like, you know, the sort of things that you get when you go to like a posh patisserie or whatever, and they've got those creams. And another one I want to talk about, which you would get there, is glazen as an alternative to thick icing. Because I think I saw you first do it on, you made this fantastic Malteser loaf cake for us. And you said, oh, I'm going to do a glaze, a chocolate glaze on it. It was like a swirly, a swirl cake, loaf cake. And then it was a chocolate glaze and then the Malteser. It was a cover cake, Ed. You posted it the other day. Ed's making this face at me like, I can't remember what she's talking about. And I'm, no, and I'm making this face back at him, which is, it was on the cover, Ed.
I think it's
Remember it now? It was fantastic. Because
I don't think of that as a glaze, because that one is a glaze, but it's a ganache.
You called
glaze,
it a basically. Chocolate glaze.
Yeah. No, I know. But it's basically a very simple ganache. It's chocolate, cream. And the nice thing about making a ganache is if you're making something that has chocolate flavor, but you want to give it a real intensity, then a ganache is chocolate and cream and is about as intense a chocolate flavor as you're going to get. And it's incredibly easy to make. It's, you know, warming your cream, pouring it over the chocolate, making it into a ganache. There is a lot that can go wrong with ganache. And I think the most important thing you can do is when you're... A lot of older recipes, especially kind of early 2000s, 90s recipes, will say bring the cream to a boil and pour that over the chocolate. Really, best practice would be to bring the cream just to a simmer. Because when you pour that cream over the chocolate, and this is for any type of ganache, when you're bringing a liquid and a chocolate together, the heat can make the fat in the chocolate separate and make the ganache split. So it's best if you can really finely chop your chocolate and add simmering cream. That helps a lot. And the other thing that can happen is some chocolates, and this is true of some lower quality chocolates or chocolates that are designed for eating, not necessarily baking, they can have quite a high proportion. Well, actually, that's a bit too specific. It can be any type of chocolate, really. But when the chocolate is high in cocoa butter, like they've added extra cocoa butter to the cocoa mass, it can make a chocolate that eats really nicely. It melts really nicely and thin. Yeah. It melts really easily on the tongue. But that can split more because of that higher percentage of fat is harder to keep in emulsion. So again, proper practice would be warm, simmering cream. And just gentle stirring until in the middle of the bowl until it starts to come together.
So you're giving it the best possible.
Yeah. But there are things you can do if your ganache splits. There's a few tricks you can do. The best one is if you have an immersion blender, like a stick blender, that will bring back ganache into emulsion the best. Yeah. If it starts, if you see it start to split, the best thing you can do is stop stirring as soon as you know it's, you can just see it, it will start to look
a bit
going,
wrong.
Get your stick blender out, blitz it together, and it's like making mayonnaise. It just forces it into emulsion.
It just forces it back together.
Yeah.
Stick around to hear more from Ed, including new flavor trends in baking to look out for. I saw a guy, I can't remember what program it was on, and he used water as the liquid. Have you ever done that?
You can make ganache from basically any liquid. So it's known as water ganache. And you can do it, but it's funny because to most people's minds, that breaks the rules of adding water to chocolate. The thing with water to chocolate is if you're adding a few drops, it will make it split. But if you're doing it in the proper way and you melt the two together, then it will work fine. And you end up with pure chocolate flavor. There's no other fat in there to get in the way. There's nothing, no other flavors controlling it. But you can also infuse that water. So you can make a tea ganache by infusing it with tea. You can make a coffee ganache by using, you know, like a black coffee. So there's lots you can do around with flavor there. But I like a glaze because there are so many different styles. So you can go the fancy route and do a mirror glaze, which is made with like gelatin and cocoa powder and sugar. And it's super glossy, but they're a bit finicky to play with. Or you can just do, you know, if you've got a really flavorful cake and you just want to add a little extra, there's a term that I really like. It's for a snacking cake. And a snacking cake is generally super humble, simple cake. And it has either nothing on top as a decoration, like a glaze or a frosting, or it has a really simple, like pourable glaze. And that's, you know, the classic would be like a lemon icing made with lemon juice and icing sugar.
Yeah.
And you make it thin enough that it's pourable.
Yeah.
And those I really like because they're incredibly simple. They're not really adding tons of extra texture or flavor, sweetness, but they can add a really extra boost of flavor, which I think is great. So there's lots to play around
with. I'm thinking
with.
Of those ones I used to get at school, snacking cake, like a with pink icing and sprinkles on top.
I don't remember.
In
those.
Squares.
I think the only dessert we used to get at school was anything that could be served with hot custard. Everything in our school was, you know, spotted dick with hot custard, or
I
think we used to get crumble, maybe. There was a really bad chocolate sponge with really awful chocolate custard that never tasted of chocolate.
Did you get the pink? Did you get with pink custard? We used to get chocolate sponge with pink custard.
It was really bad chocolate custard. It was like grey brown. It didn't taste of anything. It was gross.
It was a lot of food to eat on a lunchtime, wasn't it?
Because
you used to get full on pudding.
Yeah, I don't know how people were awake in the afternoon after a school lunch, because it was a big old piece of cake.
Yeah, with loads of like custard poured on top of it.
I don't want cake and custard for lunch.
Your book that you, I'm going to mention this because I made it the other day. I was so chuffed with myself. It's because I've got more, I guess I've probably got more time, or maybe my brain's in a different space at the minute. But I made your salted caramel ganache.
Nice.
Which is you melt, and I've done this twice because I made your turtle brownies as well, where you start off by making a caramel in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I found your method of making caramel, because I've done it twice, I've done it two different ways in the past. Mm-hmm. The way I was taught was to add water to the sugar and then melt it. That to me is the thing that screws it up.
Yeah, 100%. Because
when you do it, you just say, pour the sugar in a pan and then you gently, you just heat it until
leave
it melts.
It alone.
And every time I've done it, I just leave it.
I think it's really interesting because I think there's, I don't know if it is just an old school way of doing it, so everyone was taught this way, where you have to do a wet caramel, where you add water to the sugar and then the sugar dissolves in the water. Then you cook off the water. But the problem is sugar likes to crystallize in the presence of water. So it also likes to crystallize when you agitate it in water. And most people, when they make a wet caramel, they are not controlling the crystallization properly because they don't know how to. And so it will much more likely crystallize and go terrible than it would if you make a dry caramel. But if you do make a wet caramel, there's two things you can do. Basically, the problem is stirring, so you don't stir.
Yeah.
Oh, you especially don't stir once the sugar has dissolved. If you can see sugar, you can stir it. But if you can't see sugar, stop stirring, because that's when it will start to crystallize again.
Cool. Yeah.
But when sugar gets stuck on the side of the pan, that can be something that will cause it to crystallize. So the best advice you can do is either have a pastry brush with a little pot of water next to the pan, and just at the start of the process, just brush down the side of the pan with a wet pastry brush, and the water will push that sugar back into the pan. Or the one I prefer is at the early start of the process, you put the lid on the pan, and as it heats up, the steam hits the top of the lid, draws it back down. But for a dry caramel, it's so much more forgiving because it's much harder to crystallize it. So all I do is I put sugar in a pan, I turn it on, and then basically leave it until it caramelizes. You can stir it, you can give it a little mix, and it will go into these hard lumps when you do it sometimes. Yeah. But because there's no water, those will eventually melt out, and you'll end up with a smooth caramel. So it's much, much easier.
I use, I've got a really nice all-clad silver.
I love all-clad.
Quite heavy. So do I. I'm obsessed with them. Frying pan. So I pour like the layer of caster sugar in the bottom of the frying pan, put it on the heat, and like you said, you'll start getting little pockets that are going golden.
Yeah.
And what I do is I occasionally just pick it up and kind of just
swirl it.
Just wiggle it around, just swirl it, and swirl it, and you're right, sometimes you'll get a big wadge of unmelted sugar, but you just wait and leave it, and eventually it falls into everything else and it's fine.
The other thing that can happen with any style of caramel is when you add the cream, it will seize because the cream is cold. So again, best practice would be to put that cream in a separate pan and just gently warm it. You don't even really need to bring it to a simmer. You just need to get it nice and warm so that when you add it to the sugar, it combines a lot easier and you don't end up with lumps. But if you do end up with lumps, you just turn the heat right down, you let it sit for a few minutes, and it'll eventually smooth out. But that frosting is, I think it's probably one of my all-time favorite things that I've written, because it's so delicious And I don't know a single person who has made it that hasn't completely fallen in love with it.
Yeah.
Once you've made that caramel, which has more cream in it than normal, so it's quite a wet caramel, you then pour that over the chocolate instead just cream on its own.
Yeah.
And you get this caramel-flavoured ganache. And that would be delicious on its own, but what you then do is you chill it down slightly until it's thickened enough, but it's not solid, and then you whip it, and you make a whipped ganache, but it's whipped milk chocolate caramel ganache. And it is
so
unbelievably delicious. It's so, so good. And I challenge anyone to make it and not just eat some on its own before it goes on the cake, because it is so, so good. And I know that's, bigging myself up, but it's really good.
No, do it. Do it. I mean, who else is going to do that? You know, I was just thrilled with myself for doing it. I'm doing all these processes. Yep. But I think with a lot of stuff with baking as well, is just follow and trust yourself and keep going and be calm. Don't freak out about it, because like you said, you can usually bring things back.
Definitely.
But just have that nice kind of, you know, you're always quite calm in the kitchen, I think, Ed.
So. Sometimes.
Let's talk a little bit about other types of chocolate, since we touched on that, because I know you're a big fan of caramelized and white chocolate, which can sound really scary, but again, it's not, is it?
No. And
it brings so much to the party, caramelizing it, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I love all types of chocolate. I am a equal opportunities chocolate fan. And but many people don't like white chocolate. They think of it as something not real chocolate, because there's not quite any cocoa solids in it or cocoa mass in it. But I think it's delicious, and I think it has a very good place in the kitchen. But if you do find it too sweet, or if you just like things that have caramel notes, then caramelizing the white chocolate is such a delicious thing to do, and is, again, just so easy to make and so, so delicious. So basically what you do is you have your chocolate on some form of sheet pan, so like a rimmed baking tray or like that. And you're basically going to bake the chocolate, roast the chocolate for anywhere to hour and a half, depending on the actual chocolate itself. But you have to stir it regularly. And that is the thing that people will do wrong. So you're going to bake it really low, about 120 degrees, and you are going to stir it every 10 to 15 minutes. When it comes out of the oven, sometimes it will look a little bit grainy or coarse, but when you stir it, and you have to really scrape the bottom of the tray and really agitate the whole thing, it will melt back down into a smooth liquid. And if you don't do that properly, if you're putting it back in the oven when it's still grainy and lumpy, it will just get worse. So that is the real key, is to make sure every time it goes back in the oven, it's nice and smooth. And eventually, as you cook it, you're caramelizing the sugar in the chocolate and the milk solids in the milk powder that's in white chocolate. And you end up with this just delicious, delicious product. But there are things that you need to bear in mind when doing it, and it's all about the chocolate you're buying.
I was going to say, the white chocolate.
Yeah.
It's not one for your Milky Bar.
No, it will not work for the Milky Bar. It needs to be, generally the advice given is it needs to be about 30% cocoa butter. So if you can get your hands on something a little bit better quality, something like Guittard or Barry Callebaut Cacao Barry or Valrhona or, any of those, more traditional chocolate companies, their white chocolates tend to be fairly high in cocoa butter. I made some last week for a charity bake sale, and I used Pump Street white chocolate. And the Pump Street white chocolate's interesting because it's quite low in sugar. So it was took a lot longer to caramelize. It took about 2 to 3 hours to caramelize in the end. But it tasted fantastic at the end of it, because it was really intense because of how long it took to caramelize. But really the key is, it needs to be about 30% cocoa butter. Otherwise, what can happen is the chocolate will never really smooth out. You'll caramelize it, but it'll be very chalky, and it just won't have quite a nice texture. It'll just be a lot tougher to caramelize, and it risks burning a lot more.
And it is, you get this, the flavor is kind of like, it cuts through the sweetness, the natural sweetness of thing, and you get it. Because it's caramelized. It's like posh caramel, isn't it? You remember caramel.
That's what everyone calls it.
And we all loved caramel. It's posh caramel, but it's beautiful. But so white chocolate, caramelized white chocolate, very trendy flavor. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to finish on, you know, if I want to be a show off, everyone's doing stuff, you know, Great British Bake Off's back on at the minute. We're seeing all of these flavor profiles go through. What are the trendiest flavors at the minute that I can crack out to kind of use in my bakes?
It's funny because trendy is a really difficult word. I get asked every year about this time every year. By,
yes, Ed, what's happening?
Exactly, like by Olive or, you know, from other magazines and papers, like, what's the trendy ingredient of 2021?
What's the next big thing?
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I'm just going to make something up. But it's tricky because you don't want to necessarily follow trends. I think it's doing something that's just really interesting. That, to me, is what makes it stand out. So one of my ingredients that I love and have done for a few years is tahini. I think it's delicious in baking. It has a lot of traditional uses in sweets. You know, in the UK, we don't necessarily think of it that way, but there are lots of Middle Eastern sweets that
like
use it.
Halva
is delicious. Yeah, it uses the sesame. But it is so good in baking and can make something that's just a little bit more interesting and make it stand out as something a little bit more, you know, it's less traditional, less nostalgic, less retro. And there are different things, you know. It's become something you can buy easier in the UK in terms of black tahini, which is, you know, tahini made with black sesame seeds that has a more deep, roasty flavor.
Yeah.
And so it can really stand out in different things, but can also give a great color. I did a recipe for the column a while back. I think it was one of the first, maybe it was the first. And it was a...
Oh, that cookie, the black tahini cookie
filled with a white chocolate cardamom ganache. Mm. And that one is delicious because it's... The nuttiness goes so well with the white chocolate. It kind of balances out the sweetness and makes something interesting. Mm. But lots of things like that. So the tahini is adding depth and nuttiness and other flavors. But then you've got things like miso, which are basically doing the job of salt. You know, miso is a salty product and can help balance sweetness, but give it an interesting depth of flavor. There's a coffee shop where I used to live in Stoke Newington in Hackney. I'm going to forget its name now, which is really embarrassing. Esther's, that's what it's called. And they do an amazing cookie and it's white chocolate and miso. And again, it's all about that balancing of sweetness, and the white chocolate's really nice and sweet and kind of Moorish, but then it's tempered by the miso. But it just sounds really unusual. And I think a lot of people go, oh, what is that? But it works so, so well. I've had miso caramel before, which is delicious. So there's a lot of things you can do that are just interesting and unexpected, and I think that's always a nice way to do something just a little bit more inspiring than, you know, here's your classic chocolate cake. And there's nothing wrong with that either, but I think it can be a nice way to make something stand out.
I think in just the advice would probably approach it quite gently. Don't just throw a bunch of miso in your chocolate cake.
I think
about how you're using it. Think of it in the way you were saying, like seasoning. Or I've seen, like, you know, I think we've got a recipe for a really rich chocolate brownie with like tahini swirl. That makes sense because it's kind of going through it, but it's balanced out. So I think with everything, you know, there's time for experimenting, but just kind of go quite carefully with it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think my advice is always, because I love that people are super excited to try out new things in the kitchen. And, you know, the amount of people that will email and say, oh, I made your recipe, but I tried it with this, 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 and this, and it didn't work. And so my advice is always, if you find a recipe that you really like the sound of, but you want to add something, do it carefully and in stages. So say you are taking, I don't know, a chocolate cake and you want to add tahini or miso even to the frosting, you're going to have to do it multiple times probably until it tastes right. So the first time you, and this can be about any adjustments to a recipe, the first time you want to make that change, do it in a really small way and then see if you can take it further, see if it needs to go further, and then see where it gets. I think just, like you say, just throwing something in is going to be tricky to get that balance right. And often with something that's very sweet and you're adding something that's very opposite, so something nutty or something salty, getting that balance is key. And it's the same with reducing sugar. A lot of people want to reduce sugar in recipes, and you can't just pull it out without thought. You have to think about what you're doing. And the same goes for how you're flavoring a recipe. And you have to think about how, I mean, this is how I think about it. You have to think about how it will eat and what you're going to taste and kind of what you want to be the dominant flavor. So carefully and, you know, with approach. But
sensitively. Well, that is That is some brilliant advice to end on, Ed. Thank you so much for coming to chat to us today.
My pleasure.
So much inspiration in there. Just so people can catch you on Instagram, where you pretty much put everything that you're working on at the So it's at The Boy Who Bakes, isn't it, on Instagram?
It is. I'm at The Boy Who Bakes on all social media, even though I don't use all of them all the time.
Yay, TM. Okay. Thanks again for coming to speak to us today, Ed.
My pleasure.
So that was the Olive Magazine podcast. If you want to explore more of our back catalogue of over 200 episodes, you'll find us on all the main platforms and on our website, olivemagazine.com, where you'll also find loads of useful recipes and some great cooking advice. Why not try a subscription to Olive Magazine and get the very best recipes delivered to help inspire your cooking? To take advantage of our current offer of 3 issues for only £5, go to buysubscriptions.com/olpod720. That's OLPOD 720. Terms and conditions apply.